Well, you know, the message of God, wherever we read it, it's timely, whether it was a message first given through a prophet of God thousands of years ago to a particular group of people thousands of years ago. It still can have and does have relevance to us living in the 21st century, halfway across around the world from where those people lived. The message of God that he gave through his prophets, it's relevant in some aspects. It's relevant in all times, in all circumstances. And the reason for that simply is God's judgments and his righteousness and his character, it doesn't change. God doesn't change over the centuries. And in the big picture, people don't change. So the conditions of people thousands of years ago and God's message to a prophet to them that here comes a judgment, really, those are universals. They don't really change that much over the centuries. And so that would help us explain why some of these books of the Bible that seem like, in one sense, ancient history, they seem like it was all fulfilled and done, and the judgment of God that might have been pronounced by an ancient prophet already happened. In some cases, that's true. But it still has relevance to us today, because as I said, God doesn't change and people don't change. So we're going to look today and, God willing, next week. This will be a two-part sermon, at least the way we have it planned. We're going to look at one of the books of the Bible we don't read a lot, that we don't think about a lot. If I were a betting man, I would think that the man's name I'm about to give you is not one that most of us in this room have thought about in the last 24 or 48 hours. Maybe it's not a book we've read in the last 24 months. We're going to look at the writing of one of God's prophets, the man Zephaniah. Zephaniah is one of the... Now, everybody's looking at me. Oh, I just read that yesterday. Well, you know, that's okay. That's okay, too. I'm thinking you're in the minority if you just read it yesterday. But Zephaniah, one of the so-called minor prophets, not because his message was not of great importance, but because the length of the book he wrote under inspiration was much shorter than the so-called major prophets of Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel. Some people would throw Daniel in there. The longer prophetic books. Zephaniah is three short chapters. It's not very long. But the message is a timeless one. The message of God through Zephaniah, let's put it that way. It's a timeless message. It is a serious message. It's a sobering message. If I had to tell you here at the outset what the core, if we had to boil the whole three chapters of Zephaniah down, just the core message, it's actually quite simple, five words. The day of the Lord. The day of the Lord. It's a very serious matter. Now, we know about the day of the Lord in one sense, the end time, final day of the Lord, the seventh seal, and that sort of thing, when the events surrounding the return of Jesus Christ. And certainly that's the mega day of the Lord. But in a more generic sense, the day of the Lord, there have been many days of the Lord. The day of the Lord is when God, after much patience and much warning and much work through prophets and much delay, as long as he sees any hope for repentance, the day of the Lord finally comes when God stands up, literally. We'll see one of the cases where he describes it in that way. We think of God sitting on a throne, but almost it's a dramatic shift when you see God standing up, like it's finally time to take action. The day of the Lord, down through history, there have been many of them, is when God stands up and says, enough is enough. I've waited, I've delayed, if I'm going to be true to my own character in dealing with these people, it's now time for me to intervene. It's time for chastisement, not as an end in itself, but to lead to repentance. And there have been many days of the Lord. And Zephaniah talked about the day of the Lord. Zephaniah talked about an ancient day of the Lord in his own time. But he also has certain of his statements in the book of Zephaniah which talk about the end time day of the Lord. So as we go through the book of Zephaniah, I think we should have that in the back of our minds. Not only how did this apply to the generation in which he lived, but do we see parallels? Do we see applications to the day in which we live? I say it's quite easy to come up with a five-word summary description of the book of Zephaniah, the day of the Lord, because in three short chapters, he actually uses that term seven times. That's quite a bit. He uses the term day of the Lord or some variation of it seven times, which is more than some of the longer prophets actually used the term. I'll very briefly at the outset go through that with you just so you can get a sense of how much a theme, the day of the Lord, or slight variations on those words, his book is under inspiration, his book. So let's turn to Zephaniah. It's very near the end of the Old Testament. Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. The fourth from the end, Zephaniah. And let's do a real quick pass through these three chapters and see the seven times where the day of the Lord or some variation on that is used. We start off in three occasions, those very words, those five words are used. The first time we see it is in the first chapter, Zephaniah. I never did find it. Zephaniah chapter 1 and verse 7. Zephaniah 1 and verse 7. Be silent in the presence of the eternal God, for the day of the Lord is at hand. So seven verses into this book, we run across that phrase. And it's a sobering reality, whether it's one of the many days of the Lord that have been confronted God's people back down through history, or whether it's the final one. It is a sobering one. It's a time to be silent and to learn the lessons of the day of the Lord. So that's the initial occasion. Be silent in the presence of the Lord eternal, for the day of the Lord is at hand. All right, that's number one. We go seven verses forward to verse 14, and we see it twice more, just by itself. Verse 14, the great day of the Lord is near. It's near and hastens quickly. The noise of the day of the Lord is bitter. So there's two more occurrences of the day of the Lord in chapter 1 and verse 14. So that's three. Then there are other times when the day of the Lord is used in conjunction with modifying words. Let's look at those. In chapter 1 and verse 8, the very next verse from when it occurred the first time, there's this slight variation on the theme. Here's chapter 1 and verse 8. It shall be in the day of the Lord's sacrifice. And we will come back to that later and see just exactly what that sacrifice is. It's again a sobering reality for those who were involved. It's the day of the Lord's sacrifice. What is he sacrificing? Well, we'll look at it. Then we go to verse 18. Still in chapter 1, we go to verse 18 and we see where twice the day of the Lord is used. Actually, once here, verse 18, neither their silver nor their gold shall be able to deliver them in the day of the Lord's wrath. So this isn't a pleasant message for Zephaniah to deliver to these people. Now it's the day of the Lord, but it's the wrath of the day of the Lord, the day of the Lord's wrath. So that's chapter 118. So that's five of the seven occurrences. And then we go to chapter 2. And we look in verse 2, before the decree is issued, before the day passes like chaff, before the Lord's fierce anger comes upon you, before the day of the eternal's anger. All right, there's another one, day of the Lord. But in this case, it's the day of the Lord's anger. And then in the very next verse, verse 3, seek the eternal, all you meek of the earth, who have upheld his justice, seek righteousness, seek humility. It may be that you'll be hidden in the day of the Lord's anger. So there again, the day of the Lord's anger. So that's seven times in one chapter and two verses, three verses. That's seven times. Then, if that weren't enough to really make us understand that there's a theme to this prophecy, there are 10 additional times where Zephaniah is inspired to talk about a particular day, a particular time, a time coming. Let's look at those very briefly. A special day. Now, it's not necessarily the day of the Lord using those words, but it clearly is talking about the same time, but it's a particular day, not just any day. Let's look at chapter 1 and verse 9. We go back to chapter 1 and, in this case, verse 9. In the same day, I will punish. So this is a particular day of punishment. Now, it's been put off. It's been delayed. It's been mercifully extended. But there does come a time where it's a day of punishment, a day that I will punish, God says. All right, then that's one. The second one is in the very next verse, another particular day. And how is this particular day in verse 10 described? There shall be on that day, says the Eternal, the sound of a mournful cry from the fish gate and a wailing. So it's a day, it's a particular day of mournful crying and wailing. In another translation I looked at, it's called a day of crying and howling. All right, we go to verse 15. Same chapter 1, verse 15. Here it's called, this is a day of wrath. So there again, we see that aspect of this particular day. And then we stay in verse 15. Boy, 15 is just full of different descriptions of this day. There, we just read, day of wrath. It's a day of trouble and distress. And then it's a day of devastation and of desolation. And then it's a day of darkness and gloominess. And then it's a day of clouds and thick darkness. What a day. Now, this isn't lighthearted material. All of those descriptions of this special day. Right there in verse 15, we go to verse 16, the very next verse. It's a day of trumpet and alarm. We think of the seven trumpets of Revelation. We think of the alarm of war and coming punishment. We go to chapter 2 and verse 2, and verse. If God hasn't gotten our attention by now, you know, maybe this will. Chapter 2 and verse 2, before the decree is issued, before the day passes like chaff, before the Eternal's fierce anger. It's not just a day of punishment and anger and wrath, it's fierce anger. Well, boy, you and I don't want to be in the road when God's fierce anger is coming down the road. That's not something you want to confront. And then, that's nine additional times. And then there's one more, and that's in chapter 3 and in verse 8. And I alluded to this earlier. This is chapter 3 and verse 8. Therefore, wait for me, says the Eternal, until the day I rise up. The day God stands up, rises up, no longer sitting. God is about to take action, and we have just seen the nature of that action. So seven times the day of the Lord or some variation, 10 additional certain days with all kinds, that's 17 times. This is pretty pointed. It's pretty obvious what this book is about. Now, as I said, the message of Zephaniah, just like the message of all of the prophets of God, is timeless, even though we know that to the people he gave these words back in the 500s B.C. in Jerusalem when he lived, to the people he gave these words. They heard it. They experienced the day of the Lord, specifically with the coming of Nebuchadnezzar into Jerusalem and taking them captive. See, Zephaniah was a contemporary of Jeremiah. Jeremiah was talking about the day of the Lord to those in Jerusalem, in Judah, the southern kingdom. And Zephaniah was one of his contemporaries, another one of the prophets. Well, yes, they faced their day of the Lord. It was called captivity for 70 years to Babylon. But the message is timeless. And one way I think we can gain more in going through this timeless book that certainly has applications to us today is to get some of the background, the historical, you might even say the cultural, the political, if I could use that term, background to Zephaniah's day and age. So I want to spend a good bit of time today just building up our understanding of what were the times like in Judah, the southern kingdom of Judah, when Zephaniah was sent by God with this message, the day of the Lord, the day of the Lord's wrath, the day of waste and desolation, trumpet and alarm, fierce anger, the day when God rises up, all of these things we've seen. We start in chapter 1 and verse 1, and there's kind of an innocuous a bit of information there that I think opens up our understanding to some interesting background information. So let's read it. Chapter 1, verse 1. The word of the Eternal, which came to Zephaniah. Now, this is not Zephaniah's ideas. Zephaniah is not just pronouncing a rant. He's not a disaffected Jew living then. He's mad at his political leaders. He's mad at the king. He's mad at his countrymen. So he goes off on a rant. That's not it. These are God's words. Zephaniah was just sent to deliver them. It's the word of the eternal, which came to Zephaniah, the son of Cushi. Cushi was in turn the son of Gedaliah. Gedaliah was in turn the son of Amariah. And Amariah was in turn the son of Hezekiah. So we have the names of four paternal ancestors of this man Zephaniah. Now you might say, well, okay, so what? Well, the so what is a couple of things. Number one, the fourth one, which would have been Zephaniah's great-great-grandfather, your father, your grandfather, your great-grandfather, your great-grandfather. His great-great-grandfather, Zephaniah's great-great-grandfather, was a man named Hezekiah. Now, chances are, most of us have no memory of ever running across these other three names. But something about Hezekiah we remember, more than likely. I mean, who's Cushi? Who's Gedaliah? Who's Amariah? But most of us, oh, I think I've heard of that Hezekiah. Yes, you have. Hezekiah was a king of Judah. He was a special king of Judah. Now, I'll say this at the outset. Do we know with 100% certainty that the Hezekiah of verse 1 is the Hezekiah who was king? No, we don't. But the majority opinion among the historians and the scholars, and they have their reasons, and the majority opinion is that that's exactly who his great-great-grandfather was, King Hezekiah. And there are reasons that most scholars have come to that conclusion. I mean, it doesn't in any way affect the message of Zephaniah, whether that assumption is true or not. It's interesting. We'll spend a little bit of time on it. Just for interest, I tend to think he probably was the king Hezekiah. But why? What would be the reasons that the majority of scholars... I actually looked up, as I was working through this, I looked up 15 sources. I wanted to just see what are most of the scholars and the historians and the chroniclers of ancient... of Judah, well, 60% of 9 out of the 15 stated that it was their opinion that this great-great-grandfather of Zephaniah named Hezekiah was in fact King Hezekiah. And the other 40%, I think their objections are kind of weak. So I tend to be persuaded that this was King Hezekiah. But one of the reasons that the majority thinks he was actually King Hezekiah, Zephaniah's great-great-grandfather was King Hezekiah, is that this is unusual for one of God's prophets to give you four paternal ancestors, the names of them. Most of them didn't do that. Most of the prophets of God just show up on the scene. God sends them with his message, and they just show up on the scene, and they start saying, here's the word of the Lord. In fact, there are 12 minor prophets in the Bible, starting with Hosea and ending with Malachi. You go through, that's 12 names. Here's one of them. Of the other 11, let's leave Zephaniah here and we'll come back to him. So there's 11 other of the minor prophets. Of the other 11, 8 didn't give any of their ancestry. 8 of them told us not even their father's name, let alone their grandfather's. 8 of them just said, God sent me and here I am. All right, that's 8 of the 11. 3 of them gave one or at most two names. Now, this doesn't seem earth-shattering, but it does kind of seem interesting and a point of wondering, why would Zephaniah, of all 12, 8 of them didn't tell us any of his paternal ancestors' name. 3 of them told us one at the most two, and why would he give 4? Unless there was something special about this great-great-grandfather of his, that he would bother to tell us his name, and it was Zedekiah. So that is somewhat persuasive. You know, the practice of really knowing your lineage, of knowing of your ancestor, that is more common among the royals in any time and in any culture than it is among common people. For instance, we've known, I think many of us in this room have known for years, that the House of Windsor, Queen Elizabeth and her, they have in their possession there You can buy a copy of it. Mr. Armstrong, I know, had a copy of it. A man, one of our members up in Trenton, says he has had a copy of it. You can find an official ancestry of the person sitting on the throne of England going clear back to David, and then beyond him to Judah, the two sons, Zerah and Phares. So the House of England, it would be just one example, they tend to keep track of their ancestors. So the royals do that. That just might make us think Zephaniah had some royal blood, because unlike any of the other 11 minor prophets, he goes to the extent of telling us four names, and the fourth one was a king. So it seems to be consistent. Again, the book of Zephaniah doesn't rise or fall on this, but I found that interesting. I thought I'd share it with you. But even more so, Hezekiah, whether the Hezekiah of verse 1 was King Hezekiah or not, there is a tie-in to the message of Zephaniah with King Hezekiah. You see what I'm saying? Whether the Hezekiah verse 1, the great-great-grandfather of Zephaniah, was King Hezekiah or not. King Hezekiah does have a tie-in to the message of the book of Zephaniah. And so I want to mention that. King Hezekiah, probably the great-great-grandfather of the prophet Zephaniah, was in all likelihood the most righteous king who ever sat on the throne over Judah. You know, after David and Solomon, you know, the two nations split up, the northern 10 tribes, Israel and Samaria, and the southern kingdom of Judah with its capital still in Jerusalem. Well, from that point on, there were a number of kings of Judah. I think it's almost inarguable that the most righteous, God-centered one of those kings was Hezekiah. That might be why you could remember hearing his name when you read that. He was a very righteous man. If we believe, and we do, and if we expect, and we do, that David will be in the first resurrection, that's inarguable, he will be. I will be very surprised if King Hezekiah is not in the first resurrection. We might not know as much about him as we did David, but he was a very righteous man. So keep that thought in mind. He was a righteous man. And very, very possibly he was the great-great-grandfather of Zephaniah. Well, let's go back to verse 1 and pick up another tidbit of information. It's actually right at the end of verse 1. He tells us his father, grandfather, great-grandfather, and great-great-grandfather. And then he says, in the days. What does that mean, in the days? Well, these are the days during which Zephaniah was delivering God's message. It was in the days of Josiah. Now, that's probably another name that rings a bell. He was probably the second most righteous king in the history of Judah. Judah did not have that many righteous kings. Samaria in the north had none. They never had a righteous king. It's never said about a man up in Samaria, the northern 10 tribes, that they had a king who obeyed God and turned his heart to God and led the people in serving God. That, they never had one. But we know of at least two in Judah. And those two, the most famous two, were Hezekiah and Josiah. So keep all of those thoughts in mind, because that's going to definitely play in here. Now, if the assumption is correct that King Hezekiah was the great-great-grandfather of Zephaniah, that would make Zephaniah the second cousin once removed to Josiah, because his father and Josiah were second cousins. And as we all know, if we've been taught by my wife, who knows this stuff, I grew up where they talked like this, but I never understood what they said. If you have two people who are second cousins, the child of this second cousin is the second cousin once removed from the other second cousin. So these, Zephaniah the prophet would have been a second cousin once removed, a distant relative of King Josiah. So he probably had royal blood in that sense and was related both to the most righteous king of Judah who ever lived and to the one that he was witnessing to, these two righteous kings. Now, let's change course just a little bit. That information, I think, will play into what I'm about to say. In a nutshell, what is the history of the kingdom of Judah? I gave you in a nutshell the message of Zephaniah in five words, the day of the Lord. What in a nutshell, what would be a boiled down summary of the whole history, 300 plus years of the kingdom of Judah? I think it would boil down into four statements. You could take 350 years or so of history and boil it down into four simple statements. Here they would be. Statement number one, most of the kings were wicked. Perhaps not surprising. Most of the kings were wicked. I just named you about the only two righteous ones. There might have been one or two others. Most of the kings of Judah were wicked. They had no interest in serving God, the God of David. Some of them were openly pagan, openly idolaters. Step one, or point one, summary point one about the whole history of Judah, most of the kings were wicked, did not submit to God. Point number two, summary history. Most of the time the people were wicked, you know, like king, like people. Hardly ever will you see the hearts of the people en masse turning to God. Point two, most of the time the people had no loyalty to the truth of God, the God of truth. They were just as wicked, if not more so, than their kings. Point number three, history of Judah. On rare occasions, I've just mentioned two of them, Hezekiah and Josiah. But on rare occasions, point number three, a righteous king guided, you might say, by a prophet of God. On rare occasions, a righteous king guided by a prophet from God would submit to God. So that's the exception to point one. Point one is nearly all the kings were wicked. Point three is on rare occasions you'd get a righteous king and you would find a prophet of God helping this person be a reformer, a righteous reformer. All his predecessors and the people were headed straight to Baal or other pagan gods, and this man would come along and for whatever reason his heart would be turned to God and he would try to reform the whole nation and turn it to God. So point number three is, on rare occasions, a righteous king, guided and helped by a prophet from God, would submit to God and would try to be a reformer, a righteous reformer, would try to turn the people back. Usually you would see him turning the people back to the holy days, the Sabbath, the government, the commandments of God, tithing. You see this on these occasions. It's really vital to see and important to see that the holy days, the feasts of God, were almost always a part of these rare righteous reform movements. And then point number four, and actually Hezekiah and Josiah belong in point number three. And in point number four, and here's the one that really stands out. Even with the occasional righteous king, even with a reformer, it was skin deep and short-lived. The reforms were skin deep, just surface level. The people's hearts, right below the surface, really weren't turned to God very much. It was skin deep, surface level, and it did not last long. That's pretty much a history of ancient Judah. The reforms, and I'll put air quotes around it, the repentance of the people, it was not very deep, and it was not very long-lasting. So the day of the Lord was delayed. It wasn't put off forever. Even in these reforms, the day of the Lord that they would face, all it was delayed. It was just delayed. It wasn't put off or prevented. It was delayed and delayed only. Well, all of those things that I just said, true of ancient Judah, since God doesn't change that much over time, since people don't change that much over time, as we're going through the book of Zephaniah today and next week, in the back of your mind, you can be thinking, how do these things we're seeing apply to today, 2017, United States of America? And I think we'll see a lot of parallels. I think we'll see the things that could be today's headlines. Now, I want to focus on these two men named in verse 1 of chapter 1 that I've already talked about. Hezekiah, more than likely, we can't prove it, but more than likely, King Hezekiah and King Josiah. And I want to show you that what I just told you was biblical. All of that I just told you, I want to show you where you can find it in the Bible. First of all, with each king, Hezekiah first, Josiah, we'll go look at two things. First of all, let's get God's overall assessment of their life. We'll find verses in the Bible where God gives us his overall judgment of that king and his life and his rulership. And secondly, the longevity of his reforms. We'll see a pattern. First of all, with King Hezekiah, let's go to 2 Kings chapter 18. There is really some startling language here about Hezekiah. Startling in the sense of really good. We're going to see God say things about Hezekiah that you would want said about you at the end of your life. I would want said about me at the end of my life if it was God doing the saying. So we go to 2 Kings 18 and we pick it up in verse 3. 2 Kings 18, verse 3. He did. Who did? Hezekiah did. This is God's overall assessment of this man's life and work. He did what was right in the sight of the Eternal, according to all that his father David. Now, David wasn't his father, that his immediately preceding paternal ancestor. It was his great, 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 however many greats grandfather. Somehow, this man, at a fairly young age, looked back over his immediate predecessors that were alive in his time, and he focuses attention on the example of David. He says, I want to be like him. I don't want to be like my father. I don't want to be like my grandfather. I don't want to be like my great-grandfather. I don't want to be like all my uncles, my brothers. I want to be like David, way back. That's what he focuses attention on. He did what was right in the sight of the Eternal, according to all that his father, his ancestor, David had done. And then some of the details of what he did. He did something none of his predecessors had done, which all of them should have done. It says he removed the high places, these pagan worship centers, right there in God's capital city of Jerusalem. He removed them. He tore them down. All of his predecessors should have done that. None of them did it. He removed the high places. He broke the sacred pillars. He cut down the wooden images. And he broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made. Remember that? When there were snakes turned loose as a plague from God on these Israelites when they had sinned mightily. And Moses interceded for the people, and the snakes, the plague of the snakes was stopped. And Moses, to commemorate that, out of thankfulness to God, he made this bronze serpent. And that is still around Jerusalem here hundreds of years later. Well, guess what? The people had started worshiping it as a pagan icon. So Hezekiah even destroys that, the serpent that Moses had made. For until those days, the children of Israel burned incense to it. That wasn't why Moses made it, but that's what they had turned it into and called it Nehushtan. How would you like this said of you at the end of your life? He trusted in the eternal God of Israel. I would like that said of me, especially if God was saying it. So that after him, get a load of this, that after him, after Hezekiah, was none like him among all the kings of Judah, and if that's not good enough, nor any who were before him. He was unique. He was uniquely righteous and loyal to God of anybody who ever sat on the throne of Judah. Quite an assessment. Verse 6, he held fast to the Eternal. He did not depart from following him, but he kept his commandments, which the Eternal had commanded Moses. I'll be very surprised not to see this man in the first resurrection with an assessment like that. Now, as with many of the kings of Judah and Israel, we get some details in the books of 1 and 2 Kings, and then we can get additional details over in the books of 1 and 2 Chronicles. So let's get some additional details about this man, Hezekiah, over in the book of 2 Chronicles, chapter 32. And this is verse 32, so it's 32-32, 2 Chronicles chapter 32, verse 32. This is more about Hezekiah, part of this overall assessment of his life by God himself. So we read verse 32. Now the rest of the acts of Hezekiah and his goodness. Would you like that said about you when you die by God himself? Indeed, they were written in the vision of Isaiah the prophet. You see, I mentioned earlier, when you would see a reforming king, a righteous king, there was almost always a prophet of God there to help him, guide him, assist him in the reform. With Hezekiah, the prophet of God, was Isaiah. In the vision of Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amos, and in the book of the kings of Judah and Israel, so Hezekiah rested with his fathers, and they buried him in the upper tombs of the sons of David, and all Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem honored him at his death. Well, that means his reforms would continue on because they were deep and long-lasting. Right? Wrong. We get a hint of that in the last sentence of that verse. There's this ominous hint. After all this good stuff that's said, this is like Shakespeare would say, ah, but there's the rub. There's the rub. It's not all as good as it sounds. There's this Manasseh. His son, Manasseh, there's the rub. Ominous. Then Manasseh, his son, reigned in his place. Okay, so that's the overall assessment by God himself, has it recorded in the Bible, of this reforming king, assisted by Isaiah. Now let's look at the second point about Hezekiah. The longevity. The deep nature or the shallow nature. The longevity of Hezekiah's reforms. The real impact on the people of his righteous example. How deep was it? How long-lasting was it? Go to the very next chapter, chapter 33, and we read this. Beginning in verse 1, Manasseh, this is this boy, he's just 12 years old when his father, righteous Hezekiah, dies, and he ascends to the throne. Manasseh was 12 years old when he became king, and he reigned 55 years in Jerusalem. That's one of the longest reigns, if not the longest, of all the kings. He was on the throne from age 12 to whatever that is, 67. But, there you have it, verse 2, he did evil in the sight of the Eternal, according to the abominations of the nation. We go very quickly from righteous Hezekiah to not just evil, but that special category of evil known as abominations. In one verse, very quickly we get to the abomination level of the king that succeeded Hezekiah, his own son. He did evil in the sight of the Eternal, according to the abominations of the nations whom the Eternal had cast out before the children of Israel. And what did he do? He undid consciously everything his father had done. Verse 3, he rebuilt the high places which Hezekiah his father had broken down. He raised up altars for the Baals. He made wooden images. He worshipped all the host of heaven and served them. He went deep into paganism and idolatry. His father's body probably wasn't even cold. And here we go. We just a U-turn right back to where it had been. Worship the host of heaven, demons. He built altars in the house of the Eternal. In the temple area, he built altars to pagan gods, of which the Lord had said, in Jerusalem shall my name be forever. He built altars for all the host of heaven in the two courts of the house of the Eternal, right there in the temple complex. Verse 6, he caused his sons to pass through the fire. That's one of the worst abominations of all. Child sacrifice in fire. His own children. He caused his sons to pass through fire in the valley of the son of Hinnom. He practiced soothsaying, witchcraft, sorcery. He consulted mediums and spiritists. He did much evil in the sight of the Eternal to provoke him to anger. He even set a carved image, the idol which he had made, in the house of God. Now when I read that, I'm thinking, wait a minute, didn't he just already say three or four verses ahead of that, he built altars and put them in the house of God? What's this? This sounds to me like it might have even been put in the holiest place, in the Holy of Holies, where only the high priest could go once a year at the Day of Atonement. It seems to be that this is even more in verse 7 that we read about. Now, I'm not absolutely certain of that, but whatever it is, it's serious. He saves this to last. He even set a carved image, the idol which he had made in the house of God, of which God had said to David and Solomon, his son, in this house and in Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, I will put my name forever. Now, at this point, you might be saying, now, wait a minute. You said when a righteous king reformed the nation, the reform was only skin deep. The heart of the people wasn't really turned. Well, you haven't proven that yet, you might be saying, through verses 1 through 7, because all this is saying is how bad the next king went. Well, we'll get there. We'll see how deep the heart change of the people in general. We've seen the heart change of the successor king was horrible. But so far, there's more to go here. So we read verse 8. And I will not again remove the foot of Israel from the land which I had appointed for your fathers. That's the promise God had made if the kings would even be a little bit obedient. Only if they are careful to do all that I've commanded them according to the whole law and the statutes and ordinances of the hand of Moses. So Manasseh seduced Judah. Now it's talking about the people in general. Doesn't sound like it took him very long either. He rebuilt all the bad stuff that his father had torn down, and it says he seduced Judah. We're in 2 Chronicles. The corresponding account to this is back in 2 Kings. Keep these words in mind. He seduced Judah, showing that the people, their previous reform, just was like the mist. It just disappeared. It didn't take long. Let's go back to 2 Kings 21 and read that more detail. Not about necessarily the king so much, but the people in general. So 2 Kings 21. Oh yes, it was only superficial among the people in general. 2 Kings 21 and verse 9. This is talking about the people in general. It says, they paid no attention and Manasseh seduced them. Paid no attention to what? The reforms of Hezekiah. They paid no attention to that. Once he was dead and buried, forget that. Let's go back to the way we were. They paid no attention and Manasseh seduced them to do more evil than the nations whom the Eternal had destroyed before the children of Israel. They did greater evils than those pagan tribes that had previously been in the land and had been dispossessed by Joshua hundreds of years. They even went deeper into evil. And then we skip down a few verses and go to verse 14. We even get more. This is God's judgment about all of this. I will forsake the remnant of my inheritance. This is verse 14 of 2 Kings 21. I will forsake the remnant of my inheritance and deliver them into the hand of their enemies, and they shall become victims of plunder to all their enemies. Why? Because they have done evil in my sight and have provoked me to anger since the day their fathers came out of Egypt even to this day. It's like those reforms were never real. Now, if you have a powerful king tearing down altars and he's got the army behind him, you as a common person, you might play along. You might act like you're on the same page as Hezekiah. But after the fact, God says, they never really have obeyed me, the people in general, since I brought them out of Egypt. These reforms of the people under a righteous king were skin deep at best. That's God's assessment of what was going on right below the surface. They never have served me from the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt. So that would be the case of Hezekiah, perhaps the great-great-grandfather of Zephaniah. Hezekiah and Josiah are kind of bookends. And what's in between isn't all that great. But now let's go to Josiah, who was the king, maybe the second cousin once removed of Zephaniah, the king who was alive when Zephaniah and Jeremiah were prophesying. First of all, just like we did with Hezekiah, let's look at the overall assessment of Josiah's life. So we're already in 2 Kings 22, or that vicinity, so let's go there. 2 Kings 22, verse 1. Josiah was 8 years old when he became king, and he reigned 31 years. So again, a relative very young age when he becomes king, and a fairly long reign. He reigned 31 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Jedidah, the daughter of Adiah of Bozkath. And what's God's overall assessment of his life? He did what was right in the sight of the Eternal, and he walked in all the ways of his father David, and he did not turn aside to the right hand or to the left. So that's, again, a wonderful overall assessment of a man's life. I would be surprised not to see Josiah in the first resurrection. I don't know it for absolute certainty. But as I say, he and Hezekiah have a lot in common. His father was Amon. He was a wicked king. His grandfather was Manasseh. We already read about how wicked he was. So again, he turned his back on his immediate role models that he was able to see in his own lifetime. I don't want to be like them. I want to be like David, just like Hezekiah. He wanted to go back to the gold standard. Not that David was perfect. We know that. But he was a man after God's own heart. And on his good days, he was very good. I mean, most of his life was wonderful service to God. Well, anyway, so that's God's overall assessment in the book of Kings of Josiah. And let's go to 2 Chronicles and get more details as to why God was so pleased with him. So we go back to 2 Chronicles, just like we did with Hezekiah. In this case, we go to chapter 34. 2 Chronicles 34. Let's begin in verse 1. First two or three verses read very much like what we just read in Kings. 2 Chronicles 34, beginning in verse 1, Josiah was 8 years old when he became king. And all he had ever known was his father and his grandfather, and they were wicked, on steroids wicked. But for some reason, let's just read it. And he did what was right in the sight of the Eternal. And he walked in the ways of his father David. And he did not turn aside to the right hand or to the left. For in the 8th year of his reign, well, now he's 16 years old. He took office when he was 8. 8 years later, he's 16, 15 or 16. While he was still young, he began to seek the God of his father David. And in the 12th year, now he's about 20, he began to purge Judah and Jerusalem of the high places. This sounds like a repeat of Hezekiah. Hezekiah tore them down, Manasseh built them back up, Josiah's tearing them down again. The things that were offensive to God. The high places, the wooden images, the carved images, and the molded images. Verse 4, they broke down the altars of the Baals in his presence. And the incense altars, which were above them, he cut down. The wooden images, the carved images, the molded images, he broke in pieces. A whole lot of breaking going on here. It's like demolition. Now again, if you're an average Judahite and you see a powerful king doing these things, you're going to play along. Go, king. We're all with you. What was the state of their heart? How deep was the reform? We'll get to that. He made dust of them and he scattered it on the graves of those who had sacrificed to them. We better play along with this guy. He's shooting real bullets. He's serious about this. Let's go to verse 31. Then the king stood in his place. And he made a covenant. He's a reforming king. He's trying to get the people to follow him back to God. They've been going 100 miles an hour toward Baal and Satan worship. He's trying to turn the whole nation around, have them go into covenant with God again and be loyal to God again. Here's his effort. He stood in the place, verse 31, he made a covenant before the Eternal to follow the Eternal and to keep his commandments and his testimonies and his statutes with all his heart and with all his soul. He put himself into this reform. He was trying to lead others to follow him, to perform the words of the covenant that were written in the book. Basically, he wants to renew the covenant from clear back in the days of Moses. And he made all who were present in Jerusalem and Benjamin take their stand for it. He made them. Their hearts weren't in it. Out of enlightened self-interest, they went along with it. They pretended to go along with it. He made all who were present in Jerusalem and Benjamin take their stand for it. So the inhabitants of Jerusalem did according to the covenant of God. That ought to be in air quotes. From what else we see, they didn't do it with their heart. They did it superficially, as long as he was around to enforce it. Thus Josiah removed all the abominations from all the country that belonged to the children of Israel. And he made all who were present in Israel diligently serve the Eternal their God. All his days they did not depart from following the Eternal God of their father. All his days, superficially, they seemed to be on board with him. But, just like we did with Hezekiah, let's now see how long-lasting, the longevity of his reforms. We go back to 2 Kings again. So it's Kings Chronicles, to try to get the full story. So we go back to 2 Kings chapter 23. How deep-seated? How much a matter of the heart? How long-lasting was all this? All right, 2 Kings 23, we'll begin in verse 31. Josiah's body isn't even cold yet. He's just died. And he was followed in succession pretty quickly by four of his relatives. Three of them were his sons, and one of them was his nephew. In pretty quick succession, four descendants of Josiah, you could say, followed him on the throne. And let's read about that. Right after he died, probably still warm. The first one who followed him on the throne was a man named Jehoahaz. It's his son. He lasted 3 months. Let's read it, verse 31. Jehoahaz, this was the first successor to Josiah. He was 23 years old when he became king. He reigned 3 months in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Hamutal, the daughter of Jeremiah of Libna. And he did just like his father. No, he didn't. He did the opposite. He did evil in the sight of the Eternal, according to all that his father had done. He did the opposite. His grandfather did evil, Josiah's father. His great-grandfather Manasseh did evil. So this man leapfrogged over the example of his righteous father, and he went back to the terrible example of his other ancestors. He did evil in the sight of the Eternal according to all that his father's ancestors had done. Now Pharaoh, Necho, put him in prison at Riblah in the land of Hamath. So he's on the throne only 3 months, and the power to the south, Egypt. The Pharaoh comes up and takes him off the throne and locks him up and puts another one of Josiah's descendants on the throne. Verse 34 says, the Pharaoh made Eliakim, the son of Josiah, next in line, another son of a righteous man. He put him in the place of his father, Josiah, and he changed his name to Jehoiakim. So what a deal we got going here. An Egyptian Pharaoh is removing and putting into place the person of his choosing on the throne of David in Jerusalem. What a situation that was. All right, so this Jehoiakim is then the second successor of righteous Josiah. Tells us a little bit about him. Jehoiakim gave the silver and gold to Pharaoh. Well, Pharaoh put him in office. He's going to be loyal to Pharaoh. He's going to pay taxes and tribute to Pharaoh. Pharaoh's the one who put him in office. He exacted the silver and gold from the people of the land, from everyone according to his assessment, to give it to Pharaoh. So he taxes the people to give to a foreign king so he can stay on the throne. Jehoiakim was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned 11 years. His mother's name was Zebudah, the daughter of Padiah. He did evil in the sight of the Eternal, according to all that his ancestors, not Josiah, had done. We get more of the story. We go to 2 Chronicles again, and this time chapter 36. We come to the third successor to Josiah. 2 Chronicles 36, verse 9. And this is a man named Jehoiakim. So this would be you call it a grandnephew. This is not the third son of Josiah. It's Jehoiakim's son, maybe just his nephew, I guess. That's his nephew. So here's the third successor. Let's read about him. 2 Chronicles 36, verse 9. Jehoiakim, successor number 3, was 8 years old when he became king. Well, that's like Josiah was. Is he going to do like Josiah, his uncle? No. And he reigned in Jerusalem 3 months. He didn't have time to do much, 3 months and 10 days. And now another foreign king comes and gets involved and removes him from office. In this case, the Babylonians. At the turn of the year, King Nebuchadnezzar summoned him and took him to Babylon with the costly articles from the house of the Eternal. Removes him, locks him up in Babylon. And then along comes Zedekiah, another son of Josiah. So you have son, son, nephew, son. Three sons of righteous Josiah and a nephew, two of them put in office by foreign powers. So we come to Zedekiah. This is Jehoiakim's brother. Made him king over Judah and Jerusalem. Zedekiah was 21 years old when he became king, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. And what did he do? You know what he did. He did evil in the sight of the Eternal, his God. He He did not humble himself before Jeremiah the prophet, and we might insert, and probably, Zephaniah, who was a contemporary, maybe not during the entire ministry of Jeremiah, but for part of it. He did evil, and he wouldn't listen to Jeremiah the prophet, who spoke from the mouth of the Eternal. He rebelled against King Nebuchadnezzar, a thing which he was told not to do, who had made him swear an oath by God. But he stiffened his neck, hardened his heart against turning to the Eternal God of Israel. So none of the sons of Josiah turned to God, just like the son of Hezekiah did not turn to God. Verse 14, moreover, again, was it just the king's gone bad, but the people were still loyal to the righteous reforms of Josiah? Of course not. In verse 14, moreover, all the leaders of the priests and the people transgressed more and more according to all the abominations of the nations. They defiled the house of the Eternal, which he had consecrated in Jerusalem. I don't know an analogy, but maybe other than a spring. You know, if you've got this spring and there's no tension in it, a coiled piece of metal. Now, it's just sitting there. It's not exerting any energy. If somebody exerts the energy to compress that spring, there's a lot of bounce back. And so when you compress it, and then it bounces back, and maybe even further than it originally was initially. That seems to be it with these people. A righteous king kind of compresses them and gets them closer to God, and once he's gone, they seem like they shoot out in the other direction with great zeal, back into evil even more than they were before. Kind of like a spring-loaded evil. They just have so little appetite for turning to God and so much appetite to get back to the good old days of Satan worship, you know, and idolatry. So there, verse 14 again, all the leaders of the priests and the people transgressed more and more according to all the abominations of the nations. And they defiled the house of the Eternal, which he had consecrated in Jerusalem. And the Eternal God of their fathers sent warnings to them by his messengers. One of them was Zephaniah, rising up early and sending them, because he had compassion on his people and on his dwelling place. God doesn't like to bring a day of the Lord to any of his people at any time. It's kind of a last resort. But they mocked the messengers of God. They despised his word. They scoffed at his prophets until it's time for a day of the Lord, until the wrath of the Eternal arose against his people. What words? Poignant words. Till there was no remedy. There's no remedy except a day of the Lord. There's just no remedy. The people's hearts are so corrupted. Now again, in the back of your mind, you'd be thinking, if we go through these two bookend cases, Hezekiah with Isaiah, Josiah with Jeremiah, perhaps and with Zephaniah, things don't change. God doesn't change. People don't change. That spring-loaded desire to recoil from any attempts to get back to what's right, that doesn't change. Are we seeing that in our lifetimes? I won't get into more speculation than just say, think about it with any particular names, but I got a couple of candidates. If I were so inclined, I could say maybe there was a little bit of going back to things after they've been going bad for a while, at least maybe more godly principles, and then when that person's gone, boing, 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 and it just goes back worse. I think we've seen that even in our history, and I think we will in our future. Well, anyway, these two examples, Hezekiah and Josiah, they were separated by about 75 years, three-quarters of a century, cyclical kind of. And those two examples are indicative of that entire pattern I said, which is Judah's history. Mostly unrighteous kings, mostly very wicked people, the occasional reforming righteous king, but only skin-deep reforms. We saw that in these two examples. It was repeated. It was repeated. It continues to be repeated through history. So as a result of all this that we've seen, God's judgment, the day of the Lord, was not prevented. It was only, what? Delayed. We saw God would send prophets out of mercy, hoping that they would turn to him. Usually they didn't. Usually they scoffed. I think it's important and relevant for us to consider as we study the book of Zephaniah. This pattern did continue in Bible times. It continues to this day, and it will continue on until the final day of the Lord, which is the return of Jesus Christ. The days of the Lord that have come in prior times, including in Zephaniah's time, are really just forerunners of the final day of the Lord. So there is, again, reason for us to read a book like Zephaniah, understand it as history, but also as a pattern that goes on. It's a timeless pattern, and it will continue until Christ returns. I think it continues in our day today, in this nation. And for that reason, I think we can kind of relax in one sense, not in a wrong sense, but you can kind of relax when you read a book like Zephaniah. Relax in this sense. Okay, now, I've got to figure out, this thing that was said here, was that fulfilled back in ancient times, or is that a prophecy for end times? And try to answer that question with everything we read. It's really both. These patterns continue. So we can not be overly concerned with answering the question, was that already fulfilled anciently, or will it be fulfilled in the future? The answer usually is both. We're seeing patterns of a changeless God, and really people that don't change that much either. Jesus essentially said that very thing. Let's read it in Luke 13. He would give general applications of specific instances. And we see an example of that. Yes, there was a specific day of the Lord in Zephaniah's time, but it has general application through all time and to the final one. This is Luke 13. Look at the first few verses here, 1 through 5. There were present at that season, Luke 13 and verse 1, some who told him about a specific thing that happened. It was kind of a catastrophe for the people involved. Some who told him about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mingled with their sacrifices. Terrible thing. And Jesus answered and said to them, "Do you suppose that these Galileans, these specific people who suffered a horrible thing happening to them, you suppose that they were the worst sinners? That they were worse sinners than all the other Galileans who escaped that specific thing happening? Worse sinners than all the other Galileans because they suffered such things?" He says, "I tell you, no." He went on to say, "But unless you repent, you will all likewise perish." Specifics have general application. So we can read things that happened 2,500 years ago and say, well, that's a specific, but it has applications even in our day. But he doubled down on that. He gave a second illustration. Verse 4. Or those 18. He brought up another example. Those 18 on whom the tower in Siloam fell and killed them. "Do you think," Jesus said, "that they were worse sinners than all other men who dwell in Jerusalem? I tell you, no. But unless you repent, you will all likewise perish." We'll begin to wrap it up for this background material. True, we haven't really started going verse by verse through it, but I hope that the material we've covered today, which we're about to come to an end, I have one more thing I want to say here, but I hope this will help us when we start going verse by verse, for us to understand a little more what we're reading, even with application to our day and age and to us personally. But I want to say this, kind of a summary of everything we've looked at today. There is a principle in the judgments of God, in the days of the Lord, whenever they happen, to whomever they happen specifically, there's a principle. It's kind of an unchanging principle. And it is this: unto whom much is given, much is expected, or much is required. Unto whom much is given, much is required. We are in Luke 13. Just turn to the previous page, Luke 12. And we see that principle. Luke 12, verse 48. The second half of verse 48. For everyone to whom much is given, from him much will be required. That's a principle of God's judgment that is timeless. And again, I say, When Judah and Israel faced their days of the Lord, it seemed pretty severe. It even seemed more severe than God's judgment on Gentile nations at times. Well, I think that principle is in play there. What nations in all of world history have known God the way Israel and Judah did? None. So when they were given much, an opportunity to know God personally as their personal national God, much was expected of them, and their judgment was severe as a result. We see that at play. We will see it when we go through verse by verse the book. There is a second principle at play. This is found in James chapter 4, verse 17. I'll just quote it. The principle is just what it says there. To him who knows to do good and does it not, it is sin. Now, those are two related concepts, aren't they? You might say, well, there were people living in the North American continent in the days of King David. Somebody was living over here. There were people in the South American continent. Did they know the Sabbath was holy as an example? No. That knowledge wasn't theirs. So their sin in breaking the Sabbath was to a different degree, their guilt, than the people in Judah and Israel, because they did know that God had sanctified the Sabbath. The more a person knows, the more it is sin for them not to do it. The more it's dangerous knowledge to know God's truth. That's a principle at play. There's a third principle involved in all of this. It's very related to the ones we just looked at, but you could say it slightly differently. The principle of proportionality. Proportionality, you know, 1/2 equals 2/4 equals 4/8. God takes those things into account. Let's go back there to Luke 12 and see it spelled out. When people face their day of the Lord, their aspect of the day of the Lord, there is it's fair of God. There's a sense of proportionality. Luke 12, let's back it up to verse 42. Verse 42, the Lord said, who then is that faithful and wise steward whom his master will make ruler over his household to give them their portion of food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master will find so doing when he comes. Truly I say to you that he will make him ruler over all that he has. But if that servant says in his heart, my master is delaying his coming, and begins to beat the men servants and the maid servants, completely ignoring his responsibility that his master has given him, whether that's spiritual responsibility or physical, completely ignoring the will and the directions of his master, the master of that servant will come on a day when he's not looking for him, and at an hour when he's not aware, and will cut him in two and appoint him his portion with the unbelievers. And that servant who knew his master's will and did not prepare himself or do according to his will shall be beaten with many stripes. But he who did not know, yet committed things worthy of stripes, shall be beaten with few stripes. I see many and few. I see a sense of proportionality depending on how accountable that person was for knowing God's will or his master's will. And it doesn't take long for us to go from the type a servant and his master to us and God, who is our master. I think the lesson is there, a sense of proportionality. And then there is a fourth and final principle. This is the last thing I want to mention today. There's a fourth and final principle that we see throughout all of this, and it is tied up in the very name of the man whose book we're studying, Zephaniah. The word Zephaniah, the name Zephaniah means God hides. God hides. God is not only capable, he's willing, and he does hide a few people for protection in the midst of general chaos. We see that on many occasions in the Bible. The very name Zephaniah means God hides. He hides a few. He hides a few of his choosing from the general chaos all around them. For instance, Psalm 91. God hides. Zephaniah means God hides, or he treasures, or he protects. He hides for protection. We see this in Psalm 91. And we will see this, a little play on words, when we get into verse by verse. This is actually mentioned by Zephaniah under inspiration. Psalm 91, verse 7. 1,000 may fall at your side. The people in general are meeting a day of the Lord. It might even be the last one. People are dropping like flies, as the saying goes. 1,000 may fall at your side, and even 10,000 at your right hand. Sounds like generalized chaos and destruction. But it shall not come near you. You can be Zephaniah'd. You can be hidden by God in a time of general day of the Lord chaos. Individuals can be Zephaniah. They can be hidden. God can hide them. We see it also in the 32nd Psalm. You see, God does this. An unchanging God has done it before. He'll do it in the future. We know for certain He will. We'll get to that in a second. Psalm 32, verse 6. For this cause, everyone who is godly shall pray to you in a time when you may be found. Surely in a flood of great waters they shall not come near me. We read about a church, a woman in the book of Revelation who is hidden, who is protected. A flood is sent out by Satan the devil to destroy her, and the earth opens up and swallows the flood before it can swallow her. She is hidden. She is protected. She is Zephaniah'd. And so God has done that in times past. And He will do it again. God willing, we'll pick this up and finish it next week.